Committee on Revenue for June 12, 2007 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 179. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 179 deals with the apportionment of the apportionment factor for insurance companies. It does a number of things. It allows insurance companies to petition the Department of Revenue and authorizes the department to use a modified apportionment formula if the current formula does not produce a fair and equitable apportionment of income. It allows potential modifications to include the exclusion of any one or more factors, the inclusion of one or more additional factors, the inclusion of reinsurance premiums in the insurance sales factor, or any other method to achieve a fair and equitable apportionment of the taxpayer's income. The bill also defines total net income received from real property for purposes of the real estate income and interest factor. It also changes the apportionment formula from the current equally weighted three-factor formula to a single sales factor for tax years beginning with tax year of 2007. You have in front of you in your packet also a revenue impact statement that details the impact of moving to the single sales factor. And the table there shows it's broken out depending on the type of company and how they're affected. Basically, there are two categories of taxpayers, those headquartered in Oregon and those headquartered outside of Oregon. Those that are headquartered in Oregon, if all of their business is within Oregon, they're unaffected by that change. But if they're a multi-state insurance company, then the impact on any individual company depends on the relationship of their sales factor versus the other two factors. In net, I expect that moving to the single sales factor will reduce tax revenue by about $2 million a year, and that's shown in that table. For insurance companies that are headquartered outside of Oregon, a complicating factor is the state's retaliatory tax, which is reflected in the table there. I've listed them separately so that for these companies, the excise tax is expected to increase by about $9 million a year, but the retaliatory tax is expected to decrease by about $6 to $7 million a year. And the reason for that is the retaliatory tax is the way that works is that for any increase in the excise tax, the retaliatory tax can decrease by up to a one-for-one ratio. But looking at 2002 through 2004 data showed that only about 70% of that tax increase was offset by a reduction in the retaliatory tax. And so that the all of those factors combined to result in what is expected to be a small positive impact on the general fund.
And does that impact look like it's a long-term sustaining impact, or is it just a temporary one?
Well, it looks long-term to the extent that we have the data. Under the current under the current tax regime, it's only been in place since 2002. Mm. That's from 97 to 2002, the insurance companies, the state phased out the gross premium tax and moved the insurance companies to the excise tax. So under the current system of taxation, it's only been around since 2002, so I was only able to look at 2002 through 2004 data. Mm-hmm. And it did depend on the tax year that I looked at. For two of the 3 years, it was a slightly positive impact. And for one of the years, it was a slightly negative impact. And part of the reason for that is there are about 1,100 companies that are affected by both the excise and retaliatory tax, and 80% of them, moving to the single sales factor didn't affect them. Either they weren't making any money or the offset. The retaliatory change in the retaliatory tax perfectly offset the change in the excise tax. So the revenue impact is driven by the other 20% of the insurers, and within that group, there's a fair amount of concentration among the winners and losers, so to speak. So in any one given year, it could be slightly negative. It wasn't extreme in either way. It really oscillated around a zero value. But even pulling out the extreme values, the revenue impact remains slightly positive. And so what's reflected in the revenue impact statement is kind of an expected long-term, slightly positive value.
Thank you.
Question.
Representative
Butler. Chris, is the retaliatory tax, is that based upon gross premium? Is that how that's calculated?
The retaliatory tax is somewhat complicated, but what the insurance company does is figure out their tax in their home state. and there's a base, and there are a number of things that go into that. And so if a state has a gross premium tax, it would be part of that base. And so that's what the tax that the company would pay in their home state. And then they look at the taxes they would pay in Oregon.
Based upon both income and premium taxes.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. That makes sense. Steve Patterson, Nancy, and Paul. It looks like Gwynn and Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Steve Patterson, Vice President, General Counsel with Oregon Mutual Insurance Company, located in McMinnville.
Chairman Teinhardt, my name is Nancy Gwynn. I'm the officer in charge of taxation at Standard Insurance Company.
Thank you. Chairman, I'm Paul Goodwin. I'm the tax manager at Standard Insurance Company.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Mutual Insurance Company in support of Senate Bill 179A. This year, Oregon Mutual will enter its 113th year of doing business as an Oregon insurance company in Oregon, founded in 1894 by some local businessmen. Oregon Mutual has payroll and wages in the state of Oregon of approximately $20 million. The wages that we pay our employees in Oregon represents about 84% of all the wages that we pay to employees in the five states that we do business. In other words, Mr. Chairman, in order to support our organization's activities in other states, we're employing Oregonians to do the work and service the policies. We think the law to support our effort to continue to do that. Senate Bill 179 was originally entered to assist the Department of Revenue after a lawsuit in a case last year, Stonebridge Life Insurance versus the Department of Revenue. And in that case, the Oregon Tax Court and the Court of Appeals by affirmation determined that if there was one of the factors, and in that case it happened to be the real estate income and interest factor, that skewed one of the taxpayer's apportionment, that there was no way for the Department of Revenue or the court to do anything other than what the legislature had laid out in the current law, which was a three-factor apportionment formula. So this bill was originally designed to fix that narrow problem by allowing them some opportunity to work with the taxpayer to correct any unfairness in the apportionment. During the work on the bill, with the Department of Revenue, the insurance industry had some concerns. Those that we raised centered around the fact that the current law discourages investment and bringing jobs by insurance companies into Oregon. It does so by those factors actually inflating the amount of sales you actually do in Oregon. The three things added together for a company like ours actually raises our apportionment as compared to even a similar or like out-of-state company with fewer jobs in the state. The Senate committee asked the Department of Revenue and the insurers that were working on this to make sure that we came up with a bill that was easier, did not diminish general revenue, and it was fair. And we believe that this bill, Senate Bill 179A, actually accomplishes all those in addition to fixing the issue for the Department of Revenue. It makes the system more fair by removing disadvantages the current law inflicts on domestic carriers or others who locate their employees or invest in real estate for their businesses in Oregon. It makes it easier by reducing the apportionment factors to a single factor, which is easy to locate on our audited financial statements. It saves the taxpayer and the department time and resources in the calculation and oversight in preparation for that. As an example, I've brought a copy of ours. My friends at Standard showed me this last time, of our financial statement. And on a single page, it shows the sales we have in Oregon as compared to the other state. That would be all you would need to figure out what our apportionment of our income was for the state of Oregon. The committee ought to know that in the discussion of winners and losers, the Oregon Mutual is here to support this bill, in spite of the fact, at least in the first year that we can see in the foreseeable future, our taxes will go up. We have no real estate investment or income in Oregon. We just completed a $10 million office building up in McMinnville. I can tell you that our chairman and CEO is very proud of the building, but we got a lot of space that we couldn't rent even if we wanted to, because a single dollar of rent in any of our facilities would take our apportionment factor for real estate income from 0% to 100%, because we have no other real estate income outside of the state. So all of our that factor would go to 100%, which if you were to add that to the other two factors and average them out, would increase our taxes almost double.
Now you're talking about under the current law.
Under the current law, yes.
Thank
you. I've included in my written testimony an example for you to see the disparity. This example shows Oregon Mutual, and I've simplified it with round numbers to make it easier to explain. But our approximate actual apportionment figures and an out-of-state competitor, which is fictional for these purposes, that perhaps direct markets and sells over the Internet or through call centers not located in Oregon. You can see that if wages and commissions, if there were differential of really any kind, here it's rather unique as the competitor would be direct marketing, not paying commissions in the state or very few. If we had the exact same real estate interest and income, which is here at zero, and the exact same sales, the taxes for the out-of-state competitor, who does not employ people in Oregon, or as many, would be about a 15% differential that they would have an advantage. Under Senate Bill 179, which is the last line in that example, you can see that it goes only on a sales factor, and so if they sell the same amount as a portion to Oregon from other states, their tax basis would be the same for apportioning their income. Senate Bill 179A encourages investment in Oregon. There have been companies that have moved out of state or moved parts of their operations out of state. Oregon Mutual proudly has our employees here, and as we grow, we'd like to continue to grow in Oregon. We'd like this tax system to treat us in a manner that encourages that. We think that passing this bill will not only fix the Department of Revenue's issue on past year's taxes, but will encourage insurers to locate and expand in Oregon. It's good public policy and good for Oregon, and we ask for your support. And I certainly would answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Please.
Chairman Bernhardt, members of the committee, I'm afraid that I have the dubious honor of submitting written testimony that misspells the chairman's name. So while you may soon forget my testimony, you won't forget that I did that. And so I apologize for that inadvertent error. This statement is on behalf of Standard Insurance Company, Oregon's largest domestic insurer and financial services company, an employer of over 2,200 individuals in Oregon. That's with a payroll of $150 million. As many of you know, the Standard recently celebrated its 100th year anniversary as an Oregon-based company, and we pride ourselves on being involved in the Oregon community. Today, the Standard provides insurance and financial services to over 8 million Americans, including many groups and individuals in Oregon. As you consider Senate Bill 179A, it is important that you focus on five key points. First and foremost, this bill is a revenue raiser, a modest revenue raiser, as Chris has informed us. Second, most companies doing business in Oregon report their income based on a single sales apportionment factor. That is, all companies but insurance companies. Clearly, the same logic used by the legislature to change to a single factor apportionment should be applied to insurance companies. Thus, I consider this bill as additional cleanup from the original 2005 legislation. third over the last 10 years, which dates myself, most states have been moving to single sales factor apportionment regimen in one form or the other. At last count, 18 states have adopted a single sales factor. 24 states use a double-weighted, in one instance, a triple-weighted sales factor. Two states, South Carolina and Minnesota, moved to a single sales factor in 2007. Two states, Wisconsin and Georgia, are moving to a single sales factor in 2008. Three states have no income tax. One state, Oregon, taxes insurance companies using a three-factor regimen and non-insurance companies using a single sales factor.
Ms. Gwynn, I think I'm aware that you're reading your testimony, and we can read it probably more quickly. If you could summarize the key points, that would be very helpful.
We have
a number of other bills to deal with this
during this session.
Well, thank you.
I'll summarize it. There's just a few points. Simplicity for the Department of Revenue, for us as people trying to comply. Fairness. Other corporations in Oregon have this. Many other states are going this way as well. And so fairness in that sense toward the insurance companies who have been overlooked, essentially. And the fact that it's just a modest revenue regime, essentially revenue neutral kind of in the big picture. But those three points, I think, are the things that we'd like to leave you with to kind of summarize our position.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I did not hear the beginning of your testimony, but when taxes go up on insurance companies, what effect does that have on their rates?
On our effective rate for financial reporting purposes?
No,
I'm
clarifying.
What you charge to people who buy your insurance.
Yeah, we do pass that on to our insurance. I mean, there is some loading charges that are passed on not only for state income taxes, but for premium taxes in other states as well.
So to clarify or follow up, Mr. Chair, so to the extent that this bill, as you point out, does raise revenue by, it looks like, raising revenue from out-of-state headquartered insurance companies, would we assume then that they would pass that increase along?
That's correct. I would assume that.
Well, and then the final follow-up on that question would be, does that give insurance companies headquartered in Oregon a small advantage just because of the tax change in the competitive market for insurance sales?
Well, Chairman Barnhart, actually I think it levels the playing field. From the standard of a P&C company like ours, when we're paying a higher percentage, we have a higher load factor for taxes based on the fact that we have most of our employees in Oregon. People who don't have that same factor weighted in. So to the extent this is switching things, we believe it's going to switch things to a level of playing field for the companies that are here in Oregon doing business.
Thank you, and that's already contained in your testimony. I appreciate the reminder. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a potential that leveling the playing field, that we might be able to encourage out-of-state insurance companies to actually set up offices and do more business in Oregon? Basically, new competitors for all you folks?
Absolutely, I believe so, because they would be subject to the single sales factor. Again, they wouldn't be there wouldn't be a detriment in their paying taxes because they'd have to include payroll and or real estate and investment income.
Representative Butler, prior to joining Oregon Mutual, in the middle of last year, I spent 14 years with State Farm, whose home state is Illinois, along with Allstate. The state of Illinois has a single sales factor, and I know based on the number of employees that State Farm had there, if it were any other way, I'm sure they would throw an absolute fit. It absolutely does encourage people to. And will we see people pick up from somewhere else and come here? That might be unlikely, but as people try to grow their business in Oregon, are we likely to see them put a regional office here or continue to house their employees here as they grow elsewhere? I think that's where the real benefit of this might be for the growth.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Deborah Buchanan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, I've handed out just a one-page summary of the issues that the department had in the original bill. You've already heard testimony about the Stonebridge case from about a year ago, where the court ruled that there was no alternative to the statutory apportionment requirements, and in that case the tax was canceled by the court because we didn't have an option to do something other than what is in the statute. There were two other issues in the original bill that we were trying to deal with. One is that one of the factors can actually, in the calculations, result in a negative factor. And the question is, what do you do in that mathematical formula when you have a negative factor? So the original bill clarified that if you have a negative factor, you adjust it to zero. You don't actually use a negative. The other question that we were trying to clarify in the original bill is, when one of the factors is totally non-existent in the business, how do you account for that in the mathematics? And if you think of what's actually happening here, what you have are three factors that are being averaged. You have a numerator, a denominator of the first factor, a numerator, denominator of the second factor, a numerator, denominator of the third factor, and you're averaging those three fractions. When you have zero divided by zero, what is the answer? And what we clarified in the original bill, or we're trying to clarify, is that when you have zero divided by zero, you throw it out. So if one factor is totally non-existent, instead of using three factors, you would use two factors. So those are the provisions that were in the original bill. The amended bill, the A. Engrossed version, deals with those two issues that I just mentioned, because starting 1/1/07, you move to a single sales factor, so those don't come into play any longer. The amended bill also clarifies that for years prior to 1/1/07, the negative factor would be adjusted to zero, and if a factor is non-existent, it's thrown out, and that's the practice that the department has followed. And then, as was testified to, starting with tax years 1/1/07, it would move to a single sales factor. And, Mr. Chairman, that's purely a policy decision for you. We can administer that change if that's the direction you wish to go. And I'd be happy to try to answer questions, Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
So, Deborah, if an insurance company has no real property in the state of Oregon, that factor is just thrown out and you would use the two factors?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, it is thrown out only if there is no real property in Oregon and no real property anywhere else.
Okay.
So it has to be totally non-existent in the business for the factor to be excluded.
Okay.
If they have zero in Oregon but property elsewhere, that factor is still included in the calculation. So there would be three factors.
Okay.
Now, that's under the current law.
Mr. Chairman, it was the way we interpreted the current law, and it's how the original bill clarified the current law. To say that is the practice. One is it's totally excluded if it does not exist in the business.
Right. I understand that point. The question I have is a different one. Does the single factor, the single sales factor, deal with that issue, although in a different way?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it does, because
you have no sales in Oregon. You're not doing business here, and we don't care. You're not going to be faced with a tax in any event, are you?
Correct. And the other factors, because they don't enter into the apportionment formula, it doesn't matter whether they exist in the business or not. In other words, if you're only using the sales, if there are no sales in Oregon or anywhere, presumably they're probably not doing business.
All right. How does the statute deal with the issue of alternative apportionment if needed to fairly reflect business activity in Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, the alternative apportionment language is in the bill, in the A. Engrossed version. It does apply to years before 1/1/07 and 1/1/07 and later. So that would apply to any year that, if the statutory formula results in an, has an unfair result, doesn't fairly reflect the business activity in Oregon, an alternative method can be used by the department, or the taxpayer could ask for an alternative method. So it does exist in the bill as it is now.
And does it? Is there a formula in the bill that describes what you can do?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe
I'm a little puzzled about that. We could write an income tax law that says your income tax is such and such, except if it's not fair, and then the department will figure out another way to do it.
Mr. Chairman, actually that's correct, and we have that in current law for other types of corporations in ORS 314-280.
Okay.
And I believe on page 3 of the A. N. Gross version.
Oh, I see. There is a formula contained in the bill on page 3 and page 4 that defines what the authority of the department is to make an adjustment.
That is what we may look at.
Right.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Other questions for Deborah? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on Senate Bill 179? I don't see anybody. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 179. Colleagues, are you ready to work the bill? All right. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 179.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I move Senate Bill 179 as A, engrossed by the Senate to the House, the floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves Senate Bill 179 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? I don't see any. Please call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. The motion having received the required majority, Senate Bill 179A engrossed goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Butler, will you carry the bill?
Certainly. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you. Representative Butler will carry. We'll open a work session, on, close a work session on Senate Bill 179 and open a work session on Senate Bill 808. Senator.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to be here today. State Senator Floyd Prezonsky, District 4, representing portions of Lane and Douglas County. I understand that this is a work session on Senate Bill 808. Representative Morgan and I, Representative Morgan's area is exclusively within Douglas County. As I mentioned, mine includes both Douglas and Lane. We're asking the committee to consider the A3 amendments to be included in SB 808. What this amendment would allow is for the two counties to utilize, if they choose to utilize, part of the road fund money that they receive from the federal government as a means to fund patrolling by sheriff's officers or law enforcement officers from Douglas County and Lane County on their respective roadways. What we're attempting to do, as everyone knows, there's a crisis in many of the counties that are in the southern and central part of the state based on the lack of certainty on funding that's coming in from the feds for safety net, as well as the money from the lack of sales of timber. And so we know that we've got a reprieve from the federal government for 1 year, and at this point it appears that our federal delegation believes it's here to stick, and meaning that we're not going to see it renewed again. This will give an opportunity for the commissioners of those two counties to utilize some of the road fund money that they have. It's my understanding that both Douglas and Lane counties do have reserves in their road fund where they could, in fact, use it if they chose to do so. This does not require them to do so. It just gives them another option, or let's call it a tool in the toolbox, to be able to have patrols in those areas of the county where they may not be there in the future because of lack of resources.
Thank you, Senator Prezonsky. Questions for the Senator? Yeah, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Prezonsky, are there any other counties that have reserves, road fund reserves, that could be benefited by this that maybe ought to be included in addition to Lane and Douglas?
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, I am not sure of any that do. I did pose that question to Representative Morgan, and she said that she did not believe they did. As you followed in some of the counties, they've actually gone into the process of shutting down not only law enforcement operations, but also some other general funded obligations, such as libraries. So I don't know if she actually did a county-by-county search. I relied on the information that she gave me. I knew that Lane County had reserves, and I did put a I guess, a request into the county's government liaison individual, Mr. Beta, as to whether they would like this, and he says that they would not be opposed to it. And it's, again, one of those things that they can decide whether they think it's an appropriate use of that money for that purpose.
Mr. Chair, I guess the question I would have then is I do know that at least one of the counties that I represent does have some of the funds available in their road fund. They haven't come forward on this, but I'm wondering if it wouldn't be beneficial if we did a blanket having an opportunity so that they may be, those funds may be used for patrolling the roads within their counties, respective counties, that were in the federal forests, so that they could continue, because they have just as much problems in Grant and Harney County, I would think, as we may have in Douglas and Wayne.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the one, I guess, caveat is where the funds are coming from. If they're coming through the state system and they're into the road fund, I don't believe they would be allowed to do so under the prohibition that we have.
Mm-hmm.
These are federal fund dollars, and as I said, I kind of got involved on this when we were having our constituent call into Douglas County. Representative Morgan was discussing it at that time, and I said, asked her if it would be permissible for her to allow me to go ahead and do another amendment. I believe her original one was a dash 2, and dash 3 reflects what both of us wanted and felt at that point was there. Personally, I have no problem with any county that would that would be eligible to utilize their funds. We don't want to, let's say, make certain, well, I guess we should say we want to make certain that there are limitations as to where the source of that money comes from as to how it can be applied. But if this committee felt that it would be better to do blanket, if you're asking me as an individual a senator, I have no objection to it. I'm not sure what position Representative Morgan would have.
I guess, Mr. Chair, my concern is that it sounds like that Douglas and Lane County have actually kept accounting for the funds, the road funds, separate for the federal forest safety net monies that they've received and federal forest dollars that they've received into the road funds versus those from the general fund that have been passed out through the trust. And if they have, and I'm assuming that there may be some audit or budget requirement that forces them to do that, then other counties who have reserves, and there aren't very many that I'm aware of. I think it's just Harney County that has some of those reserves. But I haven't heard from those folks that they were anxious or excited to do this, but it's a very small sheriff's department.
Yeah. And again, Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, I agree. I mean, that's one of the questions I asked because it seemed to me that we should allow all of those who would qualify and who wanted to take part of it should be able to have that option. But again, I'm not sure for the what would be the other 34 counties or 33, since you know of one other that may qualify. And it is there are some restrictions there, and I think that that's the one part of if there's been a commingling where they cannot trace the source, they're going to be out, meaning that they will not be able to utilize those funds.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, Senator Pernancy. I would just say that if this was an issue that AOC should be tracking, that they probably would have been here with another amendment to make sure that all counties who had not commingled those funds that they're receiving under this could otherwise have participated, and they're not here. So,
yeah, and Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, when you made that statement, it made me reflect, and I do remember that there was some discussion with AOC as to the amendments that are before you, and so they were aware, and I'm not sure what, if any, diligence they used in trying to see what applicability it may have for other counties.
Great. Thank you very much. Other questions for Senator Pruszynski?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
We're in a work session. I would like to move at this time that the A3 amendment to Senate Bill 808, dated 5/24/07, be appended to Senate Bill 808 as previously amended.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves the dash 3 amendments. Is there discussion? Is there objection to the dash 3s? I don't see any. The dash 3s are adopted. Before we go ahead, Mary, would you remind us of what the original bill does?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 808A modifies reporting requirements for municipal budget documents, and it requires that the municipal budget document include an estimate of the amount required to repay the taxing district's bonding obligations, pension and disability plan obligations. It requires that the municipal budget increase estimates in order to account for anticipated constitutional limitations. I'll add here that one of the reasons discussed in prior testimony for doing this is that the language for budget documents was written before Measure 50 was passed, and so a lot of it is based on a levy-based tax system, which no longer exists. We now have sort of a hybrid tax system, and so the intent of this bill was to clean up the language so that the budget documents could really reflect the current property tax system. Continuing, it applies to years beginning on or after July 1st, 2007. It permits the budget document to include an amount equal to the payments that are due for the current and subsequent fiscal year, excluding any amount of tax needed to pay bonded indebtedness. And it allows the municipal corporation to submit its budget document to its county tax assessor if the county in which the municipality is located has neither a tax supervising conservation commission nor a county clerk. And this was a glitch in current law because some counties...
Dealing with Multnomah County's problem, if I remember correctly.
Correct.
Thank you. Do you also have an explanation for us of the Dash 4s and the Dash 5 amendments?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. The Dash 4, which I recently received, though I haven't copied it here for you, provides a policy statement about the intent of the use of state funds, stating very clearly in Section 4 that these funds shall not be used to subsidize any interference with an employee's choice to join or not, or to join or to be represented by a labor union. That section is followed by some terms that are clarified by definition in order to avoid future confusion. And then the last section shall state that the sections will be enforced by the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and it does not apply to contracts awarded before July 1st, 2007. That's the Dash 4.
Thank you. And the Dash 5s?
The Dash 5 amends Section 5 of the bill that will enable a mass transit district to enter into transactions with entities for the supply or delivery of electricity or diesel fuel on an economic and cost-effective basis. It is prohibited, however, from investing surplus funds for the purposes of receiving interest or other earnings from an investment, or that is for any purpose other than supply or delivery of electricity or diesel fuel on a cost-effective basis. The Dash 6.
I don't know about the Dash 6. I haven't received the Dash 6.
No Dash 6. No Dash 6 and no Dash 2.
Well, Dash 2 we got, but we've superseded it.
We superseded it.
With the Dash 1. Sorry, with the Dash 3. Is there someone here who wants a proponent of the Dash 4s who wants to be heard? Is there a proponent of the Dash 5 who would like to be heard? Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Olivia Clark, representing TriMet. Thank you very much for letting me offer these amendments to Senate Bill 808. Actually, the underlying sponsor of 808 is supportive of these amendments as well as the petroleum industry. Basically, I'm coming to you to ask for you to clarify our authority in the statute to actually work with a third party in stabilizing the price that we pay for electricity and for diesel. We may have that authority under current statute. We're not really clear about that, so we're being very conservative. We want to make sure that we have the authority before we go to a third party. Basically, the chart that you're looking at just demonstrates the volatility that we've experienced in purchasing diesel, and we are the largest purchaser of diesel in Oregon, 6.5 million gallons a year. 5% of that now is biodiesel. What we would like to be able to do is to work with a third party to lock in, to try to stabilize that price over time. It just wreaks havoc with our budget, including the fares that we charge to keep up with that. So this gives us additional tools should we choose to use it. We, as I said, I think we have this authority, but we want to clarify in the statute that we do have it.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you. Olivia, would this be representative of the fact that you might be working with commodities and what's the potential of gain or loss on the commodities that you could expose TriMet to? And finally, with commodities, the potential is that you will take delivery of the hard substance. You have the capacity to take delivery of diesel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, actually, we would be going to a third party, not in the commodity market, but a Merrill Lynch or a Key Bank, someone like that, to lock it in for us. The distribution is exactly the same as it is today. And our current vendor is Carson Oil, and they also support the bill.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions?
Can I make a comment?
Yes, please.
Olivia came to me with this a while back and a couple days ago, and I think this is an excellent amendment for TriMet. Basically, what it does is allow, I mean, as Olivia said very well, but allow TriMet to probably pay a little bit extra, which they would in a rising cost, excuse me, in a declining market, pay a little less potentially in a rising cost market, but allows them to pay that little extra to get that certainty in their budgeting. So they're paying a little extra to reduce their risk a little bit and allow them to be able to do the budgeting. I think it's a good move for them to do.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
We're in work session.
We are.
I would like to move the A5 amendment dated 6707 to Senate Bill 808 as previously engrossed.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves the dash A5 amendments to Senate Bill 808. Is there further discussion? Is there any objection to the dash 5s? If not, the dash 5s are adopted. The committee will stand in recess for a short while.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler.
While we're in work session on Senate Bill 808, I move Senate Bill 808 as amended today with the A3 and the A5 to the floor of the House of Representatives with a deep pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves Senate Bill 808 as amended to the floor with a deep pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Thank you very much. Please call the roll.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. The motion having received the required majority, Senate Bill 808 as amended goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there anyone with a burning desire to carry the bill? Representative Olson will carry. Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 808. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 151. Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In front of you, you have, just as background material, the information that summarizes the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee's work on this bill. Basically, it extends the current sunset date for enterprise zone programs from June 30th, 2009 to June 30th, 2013. It also directs the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department under the direction of its Economic and Community Development Commission to prepare a report for the legislature prior to February 1, 2009 that evaluates the performance of Oregon's enterprise zones and related tax credits. Subject to local option approval, the enterprise zone property tax exemption may be extended for not more than 3 additional years on qualified property if a company has been certified for design, construction, and utilization by leadership in energy and the environmental design green building rating system or a similar rating system. It takes effect 91 days after signed on. There is a dash 6 amendment. Hopefully you have it. And the dash 6 amendment basically extends the ability of certain types of companies to have the property tax exemption, and these companies would engage in activities that result in a land transfer between a business entity and a state government or a local government if the business is located in a city having a population of more than 2,500 but less than 5,500, within a county having a population of more than 6,000 but less than 9,000 as of the latest decennial census. The next section of the amendment requires that the local enterprise zone sponsor must affirm formally that a firm eligible for the property tax exemption that's described in this particular amendment will significantly enhance the local economy, promote the purposes for which the enterprise zone was created, and increase employment within the zone.
Thank you. Hasim Squires, Bob Shiprack.
Mr. Green.
I think Mr. Shipwreck is in another meeting and will attempt to get here shortly.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, Hastina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. You should have at your places a copy of our Portland State University study on enterprise zones and then also some legislative testimony. I apologize. I also have some amendments to this bill that I'll discuss at the end of my testimony that have not come back from Legislative Council at this point. But I do have actual drafts of it if the committee is interested in seeing some of the language. Mary is absolutely correct with her description on the Enterprise Zone Program. The program last year exempted $1.3 billion from the tax rolls, resulting in an $18.3 million property tax exemption for businesses. Our association strongly believes that this program originally began, and I think the legislative history would reflect that, as a program to benefit rural Oregon and make sure that rural Oregon had economic advantage and opportunities to compete with the I-5 corridor. And at this point, we think that this program has kind of gone amok and awry from that original mission. If you look on the first page of my testimony, I've actually pasted in the statute that has the legislative findings about declaring why this program is necessary. And I just direct your attention to the language that says, especially in those communities at the center of or outside major metropolitan areas. That's something I think that we feel strongly that either the legislature needs to correct what the intent of this program is, or change your legislative findings to more adequately match up what it is you're trying to accomplish. On page 2 of my testimony, there is a breakdown of the percent of property taxes levied statewide on average. As you can see, education, 45%, cities, 26%, and then special districts accounting for approximately 10%. Some of the things in the E-Zone program findings in the Portland State report were that local investment increases show cities with zones growing at a slower pace than cities without zones. We believe the cost per job created is relatively high in 2002. The per job cost was $23,000 in 2003, $72,000 per job, and at 2004, $88,000, and it's come down since 2005 down to $61,000. We believe also that there's no independent data analysis on the program impacts and no independent verification of investment and job creation figures. And that's evidenced on page 38 of our Portland State report. This information is self-reported data. This data does not get verified by anybody else. And when we had a researcher take a look at exactly how many jobs were being created and were the jobs matching up with what was being self-reported, we found inconsistencies in that data. 20 of the 83 firms, which is about 24%, had total employment levels that were lower than what was reported in the Enterprise Zone reports. 32.5% had employment declines, which isn't consistent with the self-reported data, and 20% had employment increases that were lower than what had been reported but still represented employment increases. So we think that this program needs some reform, additional reforms, and the type of reform that we'd be seeking is to really get the legislature to make a policy consideration that we're going to get back to the basics of what this program was all about, and also provide some additional control mechanisms for how it functions and how data is reported and whether or not it is, in fact, true, accurate representation of data. We obviously, as an association, have continually advocated for the ability of special districts to opt out. I'll tell you, after several legislative sessions of having these fights, really, at this point, we're much more interested in seeing this program reach some sort of type of legislative reform than fighting for just the little special district's ability to opt out. This is a much bigger picture and a much bigger issue now, as has been evidenced by some of the stuff that Portland State has uncovered. We would like to mandate companies and zone sponsors to produce verification of investments and job creation figures, require zone sponsors to conduct a cost-benefit analysis, perfect example of that is Clackamas County, when PCC applied under the Enterprise Zone Program. They did a fabulous five-page document that showed exactly how much money was going to be exempted, exactly who was going to be the winner and loser, every taxing district, how much schools would lose, how much cities would lose, how much the county was going to lose, special districts. And it was very transparent and very clear what the benefit was going to be derived by that Enterprise Zone and who was going to lose money temporarily by the tax abatement. We also think that the legislature should set a maximum tax subsidy per job created. There should be some limit that you just say at some point, you know what, we're just not going to give X amount of more than X amount of dollars to create a job. And then finally, we think that since machinery and equipment is subject to rapid depreciation schedules, it doesn't provide community benefit, and it should not be one of the things that is exempted off the rolls. So some of the things that we would pursue in our amendments, and if they were here, I would go through them with you, but we would like to see the legislature address and refocus the statute on rural areas, non-urban areas. I'm sure Representative Butler can probably speak to the intent of the original legislation. We would like to see EDD... that we feel there's a need for EDD to audit employment investment records and conduct some sort of fiscal impact analysis for businesses that are seeking an exemption. I think, you know, it's public dollars, and the public ought to be able to see who's winning and who's losing for the tax break that we're giving. We'd also like to prevent the carving out of small areas to establish eligibility for designation. There's a whole bunch of criteria in there that basically you can just get around it with a loophole, and we think that that is something that the legislature should address. And if Mr. Shipwreck were here, he would have a whole bunch of things, and I'm sure Representative Rosenbaum was really excited to see me testify, actually, on the same side as Bob Shipwreck on this issue. And with labor, it's really kind of frightening, but I love Bob, and I'll just turn his testimony in case he doesn't show up.
Thank you very much. Mr. Green.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. You're probably looking at this bill going, what do the schools have to do with enterprise zones? And I think if you turn to page 2 of Ms. Squire's testimony, you'll see why I'm here. The largest portion of that pie graph that collects local property taxes are school districts. And what I'm here to ask is that when you do enterprise zones and you allow folks to create enterprise zones, one of the things you want to make sure that goes on, I think Ms. Squires hit this right on the head, is when you give that type of property tax break and you're taking money away from the local governments, which includes school districts, you want to make sure you're getting the most bang for your buck. You have requested that school districts make data-driven decisions, and that's what we would request that you do with regard to this program. I think if you take a look at Section 10 of the Bee and Gross bill in front of you, there's a study that needs to be done, and I would include in that group, outside the economic development, I think you'd want to have at the table when that study is done, those folks who suffer property tax losses when these enterprise zones are created, school districts, other units of local governments, including special districts. I'm not here to comment on the value of enterprise zones. I think they've done great things in our rural parts in Malheur County and in Harney County and Wallowa County. But one of the things I want to make sure you understand is when you take away property taxes from a local school district, you're taking away local revenue. In order to make that up, you need to increase your appropriation to the state school fund out of the general fund and lottery fund, which you voted on today. And thank you all for voting in favor of the state school fund today. However, when you do things like enterprise zones and property taxes are decreased at the local level, you're taking away funds from school districts. And I just want to make sure that when you do that, you're doing data-driven decisions. It looks like under Section 10 of the bill you'll be doing that. I'd ask that you increase the group of folks that get to participate in that to include my members in that so that school districts are at the table taking a look at the value of the program going on in their local community. Because I know in Section 10 of the bill it talks about a cost-benefit analysis on the effects of the state and local economy. Well, in some of our small rural schools and communities across the state, the school district is the largest employer. They run the largest food service program. They run the largest transportation program in a lot of our small rural communities. And the impact that you have in taking property taxes away and not being able to backfill it with a large enough portion of the state general fund has an impact on that economy locally. Just make sure you make those decisions and you understand the impacts of those decisions.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Questions for this panel?
Representative Butler.
And I'm sure we'll hear from Housing and Community Services, but
One of the concerns that I had when I joined the legislature was I had remembered the first time we introduced the E-zone, enterprise zone concepts, and nothing in the state was enterprise zone except what we allotted to enterprise zone. Now, everything in the state appears to be an enterprise zone except those two little spots. So I'd like to be able to get some redefinition of this in the process, and I hope we can do that through some of the proposed items here in Senate Bill 151.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. I noticed that there is a member of the other body present. Senator, would you like to be heard?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Avelle Gordley, representing Senate District 23 in Multnomah County. And if I'm still a little out of breath, it's because I raced down here from Hearing Room F, where I serve on the Human Services Subcommittee, and we are work sessioning several bills, and I need to get back there. I've not had an opportunity to study Senate Bill 151, but I did receive a note from the City of Portland Government Relations Office that you were considering a bill that would have the effect of eliminating or not extending the enterprise zone in North Northeast Portland. Is my understanding accurate? Let me just test that, first of all.
Mary?
I don't think so. I don't think the implication of it was really, perhaps, does it?
The Section 8 of the bill on page 5, line 30, extends the enterprise zone until 213 from 209. It removes the date to 2009 and inserts 2013. That's what the bill currently reads.
Would you restate that?
What it says is an area may not be designated as an enterprise zone after June 30th, 2009, and the bill says changes the date 2009 to 2013.
Okay.
So in effect, it extends the period during which you may designate until 2013.
Okay. I appreciate hearing that, I think, and getting that clarification on record. Let me just say this. I'm representing not only myself, but Senator Carter, who asked me to please come down here and just register concern that
If I may interrupt you, Mr. Repine is trying to get in here. I'm going to let him come forward and answer this question now, and then we'll hear from his testimony in a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Bob Repine, Director of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. Mr. Chairman, committee members, I think what Senator Gordley is speaking to is the amendments that were just contemplated by the special districts, where it would have implications of removing enterprise zones in urbanized areas, which that area would be an urbanized
okay.
area.
Okay. Thank you very much for that.
And that may very well be what we haven't seen those amendments,
okay.
so we don't know for sure what they will do either.
Well, let me just, with that clarification, and thank you very much, Mr. Repine, let me just register for the record the strongest possible objection to that amendment, speaking not only for myself but for Senator Carter as well, who throughout her history in this process, and her history goes back to 1983, has fought for the establishment of enterprise zones, not only in urban community of Portland, but also for rural communities. And I will also share with you that as one of the recent signers of a letter to the governor and to our co-chairs of Ways and Means. I'm speaking of a letter from Senator Carter, Senator Winters, and myself urging the governor and the co-chairs to keep the Office of Rural Policy in place. Hearing this particular piece of information on today just kind of made my jaw drop. I think I've expressed the concern. I ask you to take that into account, and I don't know what your intent is today. Is this bill being work sessioned?
As I understand it, there are a number of proposed amendments that we haven't seen yet.
Okay.
So I'm recognizing that we're getting very close to the end of the session. I'm going to propose that we hold it over the work session over till tomorrow, in hopes that we get the amendments to look at. But I have to tell you, for me at least, I very much appreciate your testimony
about
amendments that may or may not be coming. We'll see.
Right, and just being aware of the unintended consequences of the actions that we take, especially in the last minutes or last days of the session. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for hearing me. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Are there questions for Senator Gordley? Thank you. Back to your work session. Thank you. We've already started with Mr. Repine, so perhaps we ought to continue with Mr. Repine. And if you have someone else with you, please.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, once again, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. I'm just here to tee this up a little bit, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fish is the certified smart person on enterprise zones. But again, as you have stated on the record and to the committee, initially the bill was introduced by the agency on behalf of the agency to extend the sunset period of the enterprise zones. It originally would have extended it to 2021. Through the discussion that we had in the Senate committee, there was some stated concerns of which now are included in this -B amendment bill regarding doing a better analysis or reporting of enterprise zones in the total. What does it mean to Oregon? How do they function? Are they meeting the obligations and the goals that were anticipated? Really give an agency review and perspective and submit that to a legislative session. I think you'll find that because of that request and where we were looking at a 2021 enterprise sunset, that it was rolled back to a 2013 date, so it was a little bit more depending on what the results of that information was that will be collected by us and submitted to the legislature, that would have some, it was more of a, I think, an ability to say, get your work done, get it done in a timely fashion, not waiting to 2021. So I think the combination of the bill is such that is now in front of you. And then the third item that was added was the reference to extending the extension of the enterprise zone for buildings or industries who have sustainability activities going on. Again, another issue that wasn't part of the original bill but was added on the Senate side. So again, Mr. Chairman, in brief, that was the context of the bill as it was presented originally. Those are the journeys that it has taken to be amended in front of you today. As far as details around enterprise, where they are, we currently have 56 enterprise zones in the state of Oregon, residing in all corners and all cities of all sizes. So it has been a very used and very popular activity around the state of Oregon. You'll find them, again, in small communities and large communities all around the state.
Thank you. Mr. Fish. Representative Gulster, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for Mr. Repine. You mentioned that one of the things that got added was an emphasis on buildings that were sustainable. And I had a visit in my office from some folks who were concerned that the LEED rating system precludes the use of any timber that is grown and cut in Oregon. And I notice here that it also references the Environmental Design Green Building Rating System, the Earth Advantage Program. Was that issue addressed at all in the Senate side? Is there a way to address that to make sure that we're not discouraging the use of Oregon timber?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, representative, again, my terminology should have been more like the businesses that are in enterprise zones are business firms, so businesses that practice sustainability activities such as a photovoltaic company or something of that nature. As it pertains to LEED and LEED standards, I was not there for that discussion. Maybe Mr. Fish has input on that, but I would defer to him.
Thank you.
Yes. Chair Barnhart, Representative Gilzer, members of the House Revenue Committee, my name is Arthur Fish, Oregon's Business Incentives Coordinator with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. It's a pleasure to be here today. Glad to finally be back over in the House side. I usually have bills start here, and then I end up in the Senate and rules and stuff. Mm-hmm. But Here we are towards the end of session. And just to jump into one of the things, the bill as it came through the House or the Senate side originally had just the extension of the date in the program, and then and we're very excited. I'm very excited personally about the chance to do some really hardcore analysis and look into, you know, getting into the data a little more, and I can share some just, you know, more activity type data that we do keep and is very, I think, very impressive with you in a minute if you like. But to get to the amendments that went into the B engrossment by the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, you know, that's sections 1 through 7 of the bill, and the criteria that are established that allow an extra benefit for companies, they refer to LEED and Oregon Earth Advantage. That was what the Environmental Council asked for, but I would just note that it does say and other programs. And so if that kind of language, and I know there's amendments out to kind of tweak that or remove it or whatever, but, you know, as is, I would say that those are not exclusive. Those are really just examples of things that are sort of common out there, and that if it were up to the department, you know, we would look for, you know, provide a diverse number of programs that local areas could reference and businesses could use to make that criteria so that they got the extra benefit for being sustainable. But it's a tough criteria. I mean, that's just one issue, yes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
I would be very interested in seeing amendments that would make that clarification. It would make me nervous to provide incentives to use lumber that didn't come from Oregon, what with us being Oregonians here.
Thank you. Okay. Go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee again, I think there are amendments like that in the works. I was working with people just yesterday, you know, I hope they're coming to you. That's about all I can say. But like I say, even if it were enacted as is, we would write rules that would look for other programs as the law suggests that there are other programs, and those are only two examples. So, but perhaps there'll be legislative amendments. And again, I can talk further about the sustainability stuff. I have a handy dandy chart here that I could walk you through if you're interested in understanding those, though, you know, maybe you want to leave those off until there's amendments that, get to those. The other thing I'd be happy to talk to you about are the existing enterprise zones. They started in 1985. They have grown quite a bit. I guess by popular demand, I've been here and, you know, talk to legislators and in committees like this, and I've seen you know, them grow by 10 in 1999 and 10 in, I think, a session or so ago. And now they've been all over the state. They continue to be all over the state, and there have always been a mix of urban and rural designations. The urban definition is those in metropolitan areas. The rural zones continue to be on the order of 80% or more of the zones across the state are rural in designation, and they are rather spread out. They are very discrete areas, only 12 square miles. Most are only a couple square miles in total area, but they are found, you know, in most every county to one degree or another. And some 98 cities currently sponsor enterprise zones out of, what, 255 or so? Or 241, I think, actually, is the number of cities in the state today. So it's a pretty widely used program. A lot of businesses use it. And I think at this point, with your indulgence, I would like to provide you with a copy of our activity report that has a lot of nice charts and explains enterprise zone use across the state in terms of current exemptions as of last tax year, those that are just starting exemptions now, and those that are proposed in the future. And I won't go into too much detail, but on the maybe I need a copy of that for my, oh, there's my copy. I would just take you to at least page 3 of it when you've got it. And it does there provide a sort of breakdown of some of the basic points. Now, where does this data come from? Actually, it is very rigorously assembled according to statutes and forms that businesses fill out, just like they fill out for unemployment insurance taxes and any variety of sources. You know, we check and, you know, we look into a lot of things, and I wouldn't die on it being 25 employees here versus 26 the next year or something. But I think in general we have, as far as very good data. Now, the study in the bill, I think, will take it to the next step and sort of look at how, you know, how does that compare with, you know, general cost benefits of what these projects are doing, try to get at the sort of the ever impossible issue of but for how much of this is being done by businesses, you know, as a result of this incentive. Has that changed some of the economic criteria out there on which an enterprise zone is based locally and stuff? These are not, you know, I mean, Mary and I and others have tried to do this, but it does take, I think, some pretty, you know, it'd be nice to get some really good people in to do some really heavy-duty work on that and talk to some companies and do a lot of stuff. But just for your interest on where the data is that you're looking at come from, I provide you with a brief synopsis that has extracts from the statutes of where companies report that data and how it comes up through the county assessors, at least the stuff related to current exemptions. So starting on page 3, the basic enterprise zone facts, says 55 current enterprise zones. Well, we actually have added the Jackson County zone recently, but we will drop down to 55. One of the zones didn't reapply this spring and will terminate at least until they reapply, which they say they will in the future. 46 of the 55 are rural. They involve, like, there's two more cities now, but 90 some cities, three ports now. Let's see here, 29, you know, most counties have them. Okay, as far as exemptions in the last tax year, there were 114 different business projects. The businesses reported they have to increase their employment by 10%, so this is something they have to report, but most of them easily meet that measure. But they reported 5,884 new jobs in conjunction with 8,720 existing jobs. As you heard before, there is about $1.3 billion of property exempted in that 2005-06 tax year. And that equated to approximately $19.3 million, which is about, I don't know, about 0.1%, if you will, of total tax revenue total property tax revenue. It's more like 0.5%. So, I mean, it's not an overwhelming amount, but for a lot of these capital-intensive businesses, and a lot of the companies are very small, they have small projects, they don't use that much, they don't get that much benefit out of it per se, but so for some very capital-intensive projects, it can be a very critical tool. The enterprise zones are, time and again, a very important part of what we do to try to bring important companies not only to the local areas that sponsor these zones, and most of the projects, of course, it's just the local governments working with them, but at the state level, we do work with, some of these companies, and it is a critical tool if they're looking at areas with an enterprise zone. As far as newly completed investments that just started their exemption with the current 2006-07 tax year, that's another 43. Some of the ones that were in 2005-06, that was their last year. So now that property is going back, went back on the tax rolls. And I think that's an important thing to remember, that not only do we generate jobs, that, you know, I mean, you know, at least for these first 3 to 5 years of exemption. And that's really all the exemption is in these numbers, is a 3 to 5 year exemption, which averages about, you know, 4 years, because so many of the larger projects use the 5 year extension under the law already. So, sure. So these are some of the numbers.
Just a quick question, Art, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
The millions of dollars of property that's coming back on the tax rolls was new under the enterprise zone, is that correct?
It was new, yes.
Right,
the exemption is only extended to property in the enterprise zone that is not used before in the enterprise zone. So we're almost talking exclusively about buildings and structures, some of which, you know, have more or less stable value for many years, and even a lot of the machinery and equipment doesn't depreciate for 15, 20 years. Only the high-tech stuff and some of the personal property really falls more or less rapidly in value.
Thank you.
So, yeah, there's quite a bit. The next page just lists a bunch of the enterprise zones, and I'll just...
May I ask, how much of this do you plan to go through today? And I'm
nothing.
Just indicate that I have several more people to be heard in the next 10 or 15 minutes.
I'm just here to answer your questions, and I'm sure...
Perfect. Then I think we'll stop here.
Okay.
If you're available, I'm going to suggest that the committee take your document with them, mm-hmm. That they cram tonight, that the exam will probably be tomorrow, called a work session. And if you're available tomorrow to answer questions, that might be very valuable to us.
I appreciate that, Chair Barnhart. I will definitely be here, and I hope to provide a lot more information on enterprise zones for your interest.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you.
So could I just ask one question right now?
Please.
I'm just curious, given that there's this report called for, it looks like that might have been amended into the bill in the Senate, and that won't be ready until... toward the beginning of the next legislative session, and this program doesn't sense it until a date somewhat after that.
Yes.
What is the crucial need for extending the sunset right now in advance of that report?
Well, at this rate, Chair Barnhart, Representative Rosenbaum, members of the committee, the current statutes, as you can see, I think in sections 8 and 9 of the bill, have the program stop operating on June 30th, 2009. And if it's not done by this session, then the program will stop operating unless the 2009 legislature cannot pass a bill to extend it except for until 90 days post-signee die. So, this is the time to extend it. To be sure, and provide some amount of certainty into the future, because we're reaching a somewhat dicey point in talking with companies and their plans and the plans of local communities. So, yeah, the time is now.
So I follow up. What is the point of having a report after we've already extended the program? It seems like you would want the report in weighing the decision to do it.
Yeah, Chair Barnhart, Representative Rosenbaum, consistent with what the legislature did in the 1990s, the original bill proposed to extend the date originally for 12 more years, from 2009 to 2021. So it has been carried back, I think, to give more relevancy to review of the results from that report, which again I think will take our knowledge to a greater analytical level. But to bring it back to 2013, I think makes it a much more present chance to consider that data or consider those results.
Thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some of the handouts that we were given by the special districts suggest that the criteria that's used for designation of urban renewal districts is rather loose, and that it includes places like Clackamas Town Center. Could you explain... If that is in fact true, could you explain the logic and rationale behind that designation as a blighted area?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Witt, members of the committee, I'm really not in a position to do that. The bill currently only deals with enterprise zones. Now, urban renewal is another issue that report sort of took a shot at. And, I've heard issues about that, but, I mean, it's kind of outside of, what I really try to address here.
Chairman, I meant urban renewal.
Urban enterprise zone.
Chair Barnhart, Representative...
And if you don't have the answer, there is a simple response.
Well, urban renewal is very interesting. But I do have, I think, kind of an answer to urban enterprise zones, if you will, members of the committee. The language hasn't changed since 1980s, and I would not argue it is the strictest of requirements to get an enterprise zone in the state. I mean, that is a choice. I mean, it does bias where they can be and where they tend to be by virtue of economic hardship. But, yeah, there's a lot of areas that can get this. Not probably the Clackamas Town Center, though there are industrial areas in and around North Clackamas where I've seen the poverty pocket data from that designation, and I remember it well, and they made a very good case for why that should be there. And that was really one of our first zones, one of the few zones we still have that has a somewhat of a suburban character to it. But, you know, suburban America, as we once knew it, has changed greatly over the last many years, and these are some of our suburban cities are now pretty large cities with issues like the original urban zones of Eugene, Salem, and Portland had.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The same information suggests that the cost per job created is relatively high. I'm quoting from their study here. And if I took a look at your figures here, total invested dollars, 2005 to 2006, it looks like close to $1.5 billion, generated 5,884 new jobs. I think if my math is correct, that's about $250,000 per.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Witt, members of the committee, your calculation is correct, but you're basing it on the value exempted, the property value exempted. The property taxes are only, 1.5% of that. The numbers that were quoted to you earlier are highly inflated. I don't really want to get into it. We have some comments we've done on that report that we can provide to the committee. But, 72,000 is way out of whack. It's about five times the number. I mean, if you look at the taxes per job and, spread it over the average of 4-point-some years of exemption that applies, you only get into numbers on the order of about 16,000-17,000. And as work I've done and have in these comments that we've made on this report and Mary's work from during the interim, if you just pull out some of these one or two outliers of companies that have huge capital investments and were locally allowed to only create a few jobs, pull that out, the number drops to about 4,000 to 5,000 per job for the entire exemption per job. So, I mean, it's very easy, I think, to make a case that there's no basis for that 72,000.
Thank you, Mr. Fish. It would be very helpful for us if you would mind doing a written analysis that encompasses the question that Representative Witt asked and your response to it. And if that would be possible for tomorrow, that would be very helpful for us. If you have it already.
I don't have copies, but I can leave it with staff.
You could do that. Thank
yes,
you.
Mr. Chairman.
I would really like to get to some people who are from out of town, if I could today. If you have a question that he could answer tomorrow, why don't you give him the question now?
That's what I was going to ask. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The special districts study also suggests that cities with zones grow at a slower pace than cities without such zones, and if you had information on that, it would be helpful as well.
Thank you. That would be very helpful. We appreciate your testimony and also your offer to return tomorrow. Thank you very much. I would like to hear from Jeff Gilmore, who comes from Harney County. No, he doesn't come from Harney County. Sorry. He's wearing Harney County clothes. He's wearing Harney County clothes.
He may look like a cowboy.
Sorry, Jeff. I didn't recognize. I didn't attach the name and the face. Is there anyone who actually is going to have difficulty getting back tomorrow to testify on this bill? Thank you. All right, please.
Thank you very much. My name is Jeff Gilmore, and I represent Harney County as a lobbyist. I would rather be out of town. I'm not.
And tomorrow you could be.
No.
No.
I'll be here. The Dash 6 Amendment, which I believe your staff went through, I've been asked by Harney County if that could be included in this bill. I'll give you the short reason why. The state has a archive center, which is located in the city of Burns, which comes under the narrow qualifications of this bill. The state is in the process of removing itself from the ownership of this building. The county officials and the county in conjunction with other interests inside the county, are working in a negotiated fashion to try to take this building and put it into a use that will sustain its structure and hire some employees. They ask if this amendment could be included in the bill, which would allow this to continue. Simple answer.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And you can see we're losing the committee. Is there anything, are there any questions for, yes, Representative?
Is that the lottery building?
No, it, yes.
It's Senate Bill 69 that we passed recently.
That's correct.
Correct. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else who on the list who's without difficulty returning tomorrow? I appreciate it. Yeah. Please.
Good reason.
Graduating from preschool.
That's right. From preschool to be here tonight.
As one who's attending a kindergarten graduation tonight, those early childhood graduations are very important.
Very important. They are. Thank you, Representative Counselor. We appreciate that defense.
My daughter
of motherhood.
Constituent of Representative Gelser's, and she is graduating from Old Mill Preschool tomorrow, so I want to be there for that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, from what I understand...
For the record,
I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. And from what I understand, I think Lindsay is going to testify tomorrow with Chris Jarmer on Section 2 of the bill, and I think you mentioned this, Representative Gelser. It's a Section 2. I wanted to just point out where our concerns about Section 2 are for the record. If you look at Section 2 and if you look at sub B, the operations of a business firm in the enterprise zone satisfy renewable portfolio standards consistent with the standards. That's on page 2. I'll let you read it. This language, and we've talked about this with the proponents of the language, it is confusing in a number of ways. There's about four that I came up with. And the language says that a business in an enterprise zone shall purchase renewable power consistent with ORS 757. And those are, I believe, the RPS statutes. Remember, the RPS mandate applies to utilities, not to businesses. The utility acquirer makes the power acquisitions. They have the least cost plan and they have the integrated resource plan, and they make the decisions on what power is going to be purchased. The business does not. So that is one reason that language does not work. The second reason is there are businesses that do purchase directly from the market. As you remember, some of you might have been involved with Senate Bill 1149. That was in 1999. Oh, Lord. And those businesses that do purchase directly from the market are also held to the same RPS standard that you passed a few weeks ago in Senate Bill 838. So they're taken care of. They would meet the RPS standard. The utility or the electricity service supplier would meet the standard. Again, it's not the business that's mandated to meet the portfolio standard. Mm-hmm. The third example is the language says shall purchase. And we do have companies in Oregon that generate their own power. And that power is often very green power and also serves as conservation mm-hmm. from the load. And so, again, because the language says shall purchase, we have concern about the unintended consequences about that. And it may be...
I might have to sell off my own cogeneration plant in order to meet the requirements.
That is correct.
Thank you.
That is correct.
Yeah.
Thank you for clarifying.
Not that I have one. But
and that would be exciting if you did, but I understand that. And then the fourth is that if the language is intended to mandate voluntary green power acquisitions in addition to the RPS mandate that the utilities are required to meet, then that language clearly does not say that. That is not if that's the intent, the language does not say that. So those are just some concerns I thought I would bring to the record on that section.
Thank you. We appreciate that testimony. Are there questions? Enjoy the graduation tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It is my intention to reopen the public hearing tomorrow to hear the rest of the witnesses. And also, we hope, get amendments that have been proposed and see if we are in a position to work the bill tomorrow. And that covers us for the agenda. It does. Thank you. With that, public hearing is closed, and the committee is in recess, pending call of the chair.